Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us here today. I have been giving our listeners a bit of an introduction to your work over the past 4 weeks, but I'm going to go ahead and let you introduce yourself. Why don't you talk about your sort of intellectual journey and how it's brought you to where you are today?
Sure. I'm Professor Emeritus at the University of Arizona. I spent 20 years on campus in Tucson at the University of Arizona, and also I took a sabbatical leave or a leave of absence or did short-term visits as an honorary scholar at places such as the University of California, Berkeley, Grinnell College in Grinnell, Iowa, and Southern Utah University. I also spent a year creating the David H. Smith Postdoctoral Fellows Program during 1999-2000. That program now resides with the Society for Conservation Biology. I was the inaugural director, and I spent a year there helping set up the program when it was with the Nature Conservancy. So that's the general overview. I became interested in climate change as it applied to my work when I was a graduate student back in the early and mid-1980s, kept track of the information, and I continue to keep track of the information as it comes out. Now I have inadvertently, against my own wishes, become the world's leading authority on the topic of abrupt climate change leading to near-term human extinction. So that's the broad sketch in any event.
Absolutely. I was just telling our listeners about how it often happens in the field of ecological science or environmental science that there will be a phenomenon that each model that comes out will have more dire predictions than the one that came before. Can you talk a little bit about the increasing gloom in the environmental science community generally, but also why is it that you're such an outlier? Why is it that there aren't more people who are talking about abrupt climate change?
Well, it's dangerous to your profession and to your privilege, for one thing. It's very difficult to talk about abrupt climate change and where it leads. It's in for two reasons. One, because it can be so detrimental to one's career. And two, because it takes somebody who is able and willing to connect dots to reach a conclusion. And as a conservation biologist, I've been connecting dots, relevant dots with respect to habitat for species on Earth for quite a long time. And, I'm no longer particularly alone in this endeavor. In fact, it was in February of 2018 that Donald Trump's Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, warned about abrupt climate change. He specifically wrote in testimony, "The impacts of the long-term trends toward a warming climate, more air pollution, biodiversity loss, and water scarcity are likely to fuel economic and social discontent and possible upheaval." And he also pointed out that the past 115 years have been the warmest period in the history of modern civilization. Since then, of course, we know that it has warmed up considerably since our total knowledge in February of 2018. And all of that points to this being the warmest Earth with Homo sapiens on it by quite a wide margin at this point.
You mentioned that talking about abrupt climate change can be dangerous to people's profession, but you also talked about how there was somebody even in the Trump administration. Trump is, of course, well known for his climate denialism, saying that climate change is not really happening. How is it that, clearly the military or, that guy Dan Coats, the Director of National Intelligence, understands how important abrupt climate change. Why is it that other parts of other institutions in our society, the media, other public officials, aren't at the level of talking about it? And has that something to do with just the idea that there's no solution to it and that it just sort of breeds a panic? And if so, how are we to go about handling that better?
Yeah, no, I think you're dead on that people assume that panic will arise. People assume that since we're incredibly intelligent, and we are, that we can come up with a solution. So to suggest that there are no solutions in a society that is very solution oriented is to that's one way to really annoy a lot of people. Or as I'm often accused, it's a sign of giving up or suggesting that we aren't nearly as smart as we think we are. And, you know, I've never suggested giving up, and I've made personal sacrifices that are greater than, I suspect, 99.9% of the people listening and the people in this country. So I'm not suggesting we give up by any stretch of the imagination. I just don't see a way out of this particular predicament, especially given that increased industrial activity is overheating the planet, and that decreased industrial activity will also overheat the planet, and far more quickly than the ongoing set of living arrangements. Industrial civilization is warming the planet. So it's a doomed if you do and doomed if you don't sort of situation, where it's industrial civilization that's warming the planet, but because of global dimming or the aerosol masking effect, reducing industrial activity will cause a profound increase in temperature. So that's a little difficult for people to wrap their minds around, but it looks like, to me anyway, that there's no way forward that doesn't involve overheating the planet, beyond which we will experience habitat loss for our species.
You brought up the aerosol masking effect and global dimming. I think those are a couple of very concepts to make sure that our listeners understand, just because they play such an important role in how you tell us or are educating people to think about the environment, are just very important environmental effects for us to take into account. The aerosol masking effect and global dimming, to my understanding, is the phenomenon that, you know, all the fossil fuels that we burn as part of our industrial civilization, which of course release greenhouse gases into the environment, which is greenhouse effect and global warming, sort of trapping heat from the sun in our atmosphere, making the Earth hotter. On the other hand, there's another effect of that pollution, which is that the particulate matter or the soot, you know, just like the smoke that comes out of burning fossil fuels, also goes into the atmosphere. And even though, you know, it's kind of hard for us to think of, but, you know, if you see smoke and there's sun coming, you know, smoke will cast a shadow. So basically all that smoke and stuff that we're letting out into the atmosphere is casting a bit of a shadow on the Earth, which makes the Earth cooler than it would be if that smoke were not there casting a shadow. So you're saying that, you know, lots of times we, even sort of the, we think of the most we can do or the environment would be to show off our economy and just, you know, accept a huge cataclysm, but just to prevent greenhouse gases from going into the environment. Your point here is that that would not actually help us in the short term, because there are also effects of, you know, our industrial activity, you know, putting smoke into the atmosphere, that are bringing the temperature down relative to where it would be if we stopped those. Did I basically explain that correctly?
Yes, that's right on target. And it's interesting, I would not have moved off-grid and made significant personal sacrifices, including opting out of the monetary system 10 and a half years ago, had I known about the aerosol masking effect, which is synonymous with global dimming. But I didn't know about it until I read a paper by Hansen and colleagues in December 2011. That's when their paper was published, and I came across it a few months later. And that was the first I knew about global dimming, or the aerosol masking effect, in part because in that paper they didn't cite any previous work. Well, a little digging by my friend Jackson Davis recently points out that there was a Referee Journal article published in 1929 on global dimming, pointing out almost the same level of dimming as reported by Hansen and colleagues in 2011. Not only that, Benjamin Franklin was writing about it in 1783. So, the people pulling the strings of empire, or at least the people informing those people who we think are in charge, the analysts, for example, surely have known about the aerosol masking effect for a very long time, a couple hundred years probably, probably more, and yet it doesn't ever make the newspaper, does it? The corporate media essentially never report on the aerosol masking effect. I've been studying climate change since the mid-1980s, and I first came across the idea with that 2011 paper. I think it's one of the most important elements of climate change, and yet it seems to not be getting out there very much. The latest work on the topic comes from Daniel Rosenfeld and colleagues, published in the February 8th, 2019 issue of Science. And they indicate, and they're quoting a paper by Levy and colleagues, came out in 2013, they indicate that we've underestimated the aerosol masking effect probably as much as by half. And if that's the case, then as little as a 20% or maybe a little less than 20% decrease in industrial activity would cause a 1 degree Celsius global average temperature spike in a very short period of time. We're talking days or weeks. So it's clear at this point, based on a half a dozen papers and the opinion based on observations by Benjamin Franklin going back to 1783, that a reduction in those aerosols, a reduction in industrial activity, will trigger a global average rise in temperature in a very short period of time. And it's also clear that because of the greenhouse gas effect, that continuing to pour out greenhouse gases is going to warm the planet as well. How fast? Well, a paper by Burke and colleagues in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, published December 26, 2018, indicates that we'll be in Pliocene-type conditions as early as 2030, and they rely upon the IPCC's very conservative representative concentration pathways to get there to 2013. Bear in mind that during the mid-Pliocene, it was 1 to 2, maybe 3 degrees Celsius warmer than it is today. So that rapid of an increase in global average temperature is very difficult for organisms to keep up with, based on a much more gradual approach taken by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The projected rate of climate change outstrips the adaptive response of vertebrates by a factor of 10,000 times. This based on a paper from 2013, and mammals can't evolve fast enough to escape the current extinction crisis either, based on a paper that came out in October of 2018. So there's abundant refereed journal literature now, peer-reviewed literature, that points out that we're overheating the planet faster than we can keep up, and by reducing industrial activity, we will more rapidly heat the planet. So I just don't see a way out of this based on my analysis of the situation.
Absolutely. So the aerosol masking effect and global dimming, those two concepts, or as you were saying, they're basically referring to the same thing. But that concept of just the idea that stopping industrial civilization will lead to more global warming in the short term, that sort of lets us know that there's no way out of global warming. But then you were also, in terms of connecting the dots on abrupt climate change and connecting those dots to the certainty of human extinction, I just was hoping that you could spell that out a bit more. You know, what are some of the dots there? You talked in particular about vertebrates or mammals not being able to evolve. But, you know, what I think of when I hear that is that while humans are, we're undergoing biological evolution, but, you know, human culture or technology, you know, those things are changing faster than our genome or something like that. So what are the more dots you've connected to sort of show that abrupt climate change is not something that human society can endure?
Sure. Well, there's a paper that came out on November 13th, 2018, in Scientific Reports by Strona and Bradshaw, and they indicate that a 5 to 6 degree Celsius global average temperature rise will cause the annihilation of all life on Earth. That's a direct quote. All life on Earth, and annihilation appears in the title of the paper. Well, humans are alive, some more than others, admittedly, and we depend upon an enormous array of species for our own survival. I'm sure most listeners have heard about the insect apocalypse that's underway, including a review paper in the April 2018 issue of Biological Conservation, we depend heavily upon insects for our own survival. They pollinate for us. They serve as filter feeders to clean the water for us. They provide all sorts of activities that we are unable to do ourselves. In addition, we are rapidly losing the ability to grow grains at scale. A paper in Soil Systems published June 1st of last year, 2018, indicates an 83% reduction in earthworms around the world, and surely that is one of the contributors to the collapse in grain harvest we're seeing all over the planet just this growing season as it's going on. Most of us have heard about the so-called rain bombs or cyclones striking the interior United States. But it's not just the corn crop that is going down the tubes this year in the United States. Grain crops are also being significantly influenced in Asia, Europe, and Australia. So without the ability to grow food at a large scale for 7.7 billion people and growing, then we can tack on with even greater certainty that industrial civilization teeters on the brink, and that at the very least it will be reduced by some measure, 20, 30, 40%, certainly enough to trigger a very rapid global average rise in temperature that is well beyond what humans have experienced in the past. And again, the rate of change is hugely important, and if we accelerate the ongoing rate of change, then we're going to quickly destroy the myriad species we need for our own survival. And when they go, we go. You know, there's this great quote misattributed to Einstein about the when the bees go, humans go 4 years later or something like that. He didn't actually say that, but it certainly attracts people's attention when you tack a name like that on it. So we depend upon these other species. That's where my aptitude as a conservation biologist comes into play, and my ability to connect other life forms to humans with respect to our dependence upon those other species. And yes, we're very clever. You could argue that we're too clever by half, and that's what got us here. Are we clever enough to destroy all habitat for our own species and still survive? I can't imagine how that would occur. After all, we're an animal species. We're vertebrates. We're mammals. We are vertebrate mammals, and if all the other vertebrates and all the other mammals are going away, it would be hard to argue that we won't join them as well. And how quickly? You know, we don't know because we haven't gone extinct yet, unlike the several species in the genus Homo that have gone extinct. Several non-human animals have gone extinct very quickly after losing habitat. The best known one I know about occurred on August 1st, 1952, when the San Benedicto rock wren went extinct, probably in about 30 minutes, although the scientific community concluded, as very conservatively often does, that the process took about 2 weeks. Either way, that's an animal that can fly, and obviously did attempt to fly from the San Benedicto Island, which was its only home, but couldn't find habitat elsewhere. And so it went extinct in less than 2 weeks, probably much less than 2 weeks. And to assume that humans would not similarly experience abrupt extinction is a concept unsupported by evidence and supported by considerable hubris.
Sorry about that. This is a call-in program. I had somebody call in and wanted to leave a comment, but they left their phone open and kept making noise, so I had to drop them. But this is a call-in program, so if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment to me and Dr. McPherson, the telephone number to call in here is 404-523-8989. Again, that's 404-523-8989. I'm sorry about the interruption, Dr. McPherson. Was there any more you wanted to finish up on that point?
No, I mean, there are several other ways we can lose habitat for our favorite species as well. It's not just continuing to overheat the planet, leading us to a Pleistocene-style climate as early as 2030. It's not just reducing industrial activity, which would trigger that abrupt rate of change even faster. There's another handful of sources that could lead to loss of habitat for human animals. And we can talk about those later, but they, you know, I've written about them most recently on August 10th at my blog, guymcpherson.com, in a paper called A Concise Overview. And I point out the various means by which we can experience loss of habitat for Homo sapiens in a very short period of time.
Hey, sorry about that. We do have another caller here. Hey, caller, do you have a question or comment for Dr. McPherson?
I'm sure I did, but I couldn't hear a word of it. It's just...
I'm sorry. That caller was basically asking, do you think that people in the media who don't talk enough about climate change are ignorant, or do they think they're invincible? And at the first part of the call, they were talking about how when an organism gets a virus, it's heating up, and so you could think of us kind of being like Earth's virus, and that we're sort of seeing Gaia's reaction to industrial civilization or something like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you certainly can view us and Earth that way. We have heated the planet. We've known we've been heating the planet for a very long time, and the classic responses to that overheating have been to push the pedal to the metal and heat even faster, our only home. Are all of the media ignorant? No, of course not. Many of them know. I've been interviewed by a few people who have known what's going on, and almost immediately after they interview me, they either never contact me again, that's the standard approach, or they have, over the course of the next week, they have other people come on to their show and call me names. Nobody takes issue with the evidence I present because it's rooted in the very conservative peer-reviewed literature. So instead of taking that approach, the corporate media has instead launched all kinds of accusations about my personal life. So that's the standard response. I'm not at all surprised. After all, there's an age-old strategy to deal with people when you don't like the message. You kill the messenger. So I'm pretty sure that's what we're seeing going on. It doesn't surprise me. It is profoundly disappointing, especially to the 7.7 billion or so people who remain misinformed because the corporate media and the governments of the world are not interested in informing people.
We've got another caller here. Hey, caller, go ahead with your comment for Dr. McPherson.
Yeah, I'm listening to the topic, and my people from they had in their tent, they understood that they had a galactic fight that went on. They were trying to explain one would be the ice age, and one would be the age without ice. So you have a certain in and out situation where you have the concerned here. I mean, in other words, he's traveling to the Gold Coast as his plan, as to the sun. And I remember, as an Egyptian airport, a lot of the general was going to go to the polar bear, for example. And the polar bear was on ice, so an ice melt. But not all the doctors sent them on
That caller was saying a lot of things that the type of things you hear a lot in the United States, you know, sort of denying the scientific reality of climate change, but also sort of getting into how, you know, when we are seeing our civilization going down, it, you know, it leads people to think of religion and, you know, all kinds of very intense things just because it is such a such a charged topic. Dr. McPherson, I'm not sure if you heard what that caller was talking about, but was basically talking about, you know, galactic cycles and just sort of talking about sort of more spiritual, like, understandings of or cosmology, for what's going on in the world, and just trying to say that, you know, we're being too worried about it or something like that. But regardless, what is your reaction to just seeing all the different kinds of theories and stories that people will start talking about when you start to bring up your work? You know, you start to talk about how our society is threatened. I'm sure you've heard, you know, every sort of religious story in the book. You know, what is, what's your sort of reaction to that kind of response that you get?
Well, you know, it's interesting because usually that sort of response comes from somebody who would characterize themselves as being conservative or on the right side of the political spectrum, right as opposed to left, not right as opposed to incorrect. And yet, even though most of these people tend to support the United States military, it's the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, who I brought up early in this show, warning of abrupt climate change. He's a former Republican congressman from Indiana. He would, most people would identify him as being pretty conservative as well. The United States military has been warning of the risk of climate change, of anthropogenic climate change, as a multiplier, a systems multiplier, for decades. For decades, the U.S. military has been warning the general society that we can't continue to warm the planet so quickly. And yet, of course, the U.S. military is the biggest consumer of fossil fuels in the world. So it's a tough message. You know, the U.S. military is charged in part with providing the fossil fuels we need to maintain the set of living arrangements. And yet, most high-ranking members of the military know that burning those fossil fuels has brought us to this point, and the point is the brink of extinction due to 5 or 6 dozen self-reinforcing feedback loops, the loss of global dimming, and myriad other factors. So, you know, I don't know how to respond to people who deny what we have known since George Perkins Marsh pointed it out in 1847, in this country. We've known this based on the peer-reviewed journal literature since 1896, when Svante Arrhenius warned about warming the planet based on burning fossil fuels. That's 1896 from a man who went on to win the Nobel Prize in chemistry. So we've had these warnings over and over and over again More recently, you look to the mid-1980s with Carl Sagan, the great scientist and popularizer of science, on the floor of Congress, warning us that if we didn't stop burning fossil fuels, we would end up right about exactly where we are today. So, you know, it's easy to deny me as some sort of crazy man, but to deny all the evidence and all the other people who have been pointing out this message for a really long period of time, including the Director of National Intelligence in the Trump administration, I don't think that makes any sense. You know, we have reached a collective consensus in the scientific community that human activities are overheating the planet. If you don't want to believe that, that's fine. That's my response. I don't have much time to argue with those kinds of folks, and so generally I don't.
We actually have another caller here. Hey, caller, go ahead with your comment for Dr. McPherson.
And I really appreciate some of your viewpoints, but in a way, I see climate change more as a symptom of a larger problem, and that's more around consumerism, and it's awfully hard to convince people that they don't need a brand new car every 3 years, or they don't need this big truck that they're driving around that, you know, gets 2 miles to the gallon. And it's even harder to convince people of the world to see countries like us doing these sorts of things and enacting these and acting out these American dreams. And it's so hard for us to break that cycle because they want more, and they're always going to want more. And it's hard for us to tell them, like, if you want more, you're endangering the lives of your children and your children's children.
I actually...
Go ahead, Dr. McPherson.
Yeah, I heard that comment, and I absolutely agree. Climate change, and ultimately abrupt climate change, is a symptom of this set of living arrangements. We have known for a very long time that pouring fossil fuels into the atmosphere will have the kinds of effects that we're observing. In addition, we've been warned about abrupt climate change for many years. It was the New York director of the United Nations Environment Program in 1989 who pointed out that we have 10 years before we trigger self-reinforcing feedback loops that will take the situation beyond human control. That was 1989, which indicates that in 1999 we had reached the point of no return, and that was 20 years ago. Climate science speaker and writer David Spratt indicated that we actually triggered those self-reinforcing feedback loops somewhere between a quarter degree and a half a degree above the 1750 baseline. The United Nations, as a body, the Advisory Group on Greenhouse Gases for the United Nations, warned in October of 1990 that we had up to 1 degree before we could trigger those self-reinforcing feedback loops. That was the absolute upper limit. And then Spratt comes along in 2014 and says we triggered them at somewhere between a quarter and a half a degree. All of this tells me that we have known for a long time where we were headed, and we kept going in that direction. In addition, we triggered those self-reinforcing feedback loops. If it was a quarter degree above the 1750 baseline, when it was about 13.5 degrees Celsius, the global average temperature, if we triggered those self-reinforcing feedback loops at, say, 13.75 degrees, well, that was a long time ago. I suspect nobody alive today was alive then at a quarter of a degree. So on the one hand, yes, we've known for a long time, and yes, we've triggered these self-reinforcing feedback loops, and yes, it looks like we're losing habitat very rapidly. But it's not my fault, and it's not your fault. It's not the fault of anybody listening. It's the collective fault of all of us cooperating in a system that it appeared we had no choice but to cooperate as part of. Now, I tried to show another way a dozen years ago, and that attracted very little attention. As it turns out, that's probably excellent, because had a lot of other people jumped off grid with me, we probably would have lost enough of the aerosol masking effect that we would have lost habitat for all humans on Earth by now. If you think we're not losing habitat, then you haven't spent much time in Central America, where people are fleeing because they no longer have the ability to grow food, unlike they've been doing for generations. Same applies to Northern Africa, the Middle East. People are fleeing those areas because they can no longer grow food. They're not going on vacation. They're not trying to enter into the United States at our southern border because they want to go to Disneyland. They're entering because they're starving to death. They would not leave the homes, the only homes they've ever known, in many cases for many generations, just for sport. They're desperate. And it's not just Central America. It's not just Middle East. It's not just Northern Africa. It's Alaska. Many places losing habitat already. It's sea level rise on in the South Pacific, in island states where people are being forced to leave. It's hurricanes, the likes of which we've never seen before, destroying places like Bermuda earlier this week. So, if you can't see it at this point, I don't know what it's going to take. And yes, it's a symptom of this set of living arrangements, like so many other symptoms that we choose to turn away from. So I agree with the caller, and I go a step further and point out that no one of us, no 10 of us, no 1,000 of us who are listening to this show can be held responsible for what is happening. We came into this world, we didn't know how it operated, we did pretty much what everybody else did, jumped on the treadmill, went to school, had the 2.5 children, the whole thing, and we didn't know. And if we had known, would it have made a difference? I don't know. You know, cultural pressure, societal pressure is pretty great, and to overcome that sort of pressure requires a remarkable human being to be able to do that at the level of a few billion people. And or even to turn back the clock and make it a few hundred million people. I'm not sure that could be done either. But in any event, it is what it is. Where we are, where we are at now, because of decisions made by a large number of people going back a very long time. So what do we do? How we live defines who we become. And so let's try to live with decency and with full honesty, by telling the full truth about where we're at, instead of continually jumping back to or relying upon myths that don't make any sense. So, you know, people ask me frequently, what was the wrong turn we took as Homo sapiens to get to this point? And I think we came to many proverbial forks in the road, and as nearly as I can tell, every single case we took the wrong turn. And was it when we harnessed fire? Was it when we harnessed the electron? When we entered the nuclear age? Was it when we started growing food at large scale, growing grains that we were able to store? Was it during the cognitive revolution when our brains rewired themselves 30 to 70,000 years ago? You know, you could point to all of those different periods in time and claim that that's when we crossed the Rubicon. But I think it's pretty hard to argue at this point that we haven't crossed the Rubicon. And the only issue is how we live. How do we treat each other? How do we live today in light of the terminal diagnosis we were all given at birth?
So we're well over the halfway point of the show here. It's my duty to remind the listeners you're listening to Speaking Broadly with Adam Wadley here on WRFG Atlanta. You can follow at Speaking Broadly Show on Instagram or go to speakingbroadlyshow.com to listen to previous shows. But we actually got another caller here. Caller number two, caller, if you're still there, go ahead with your question or comment for Dr. McPherson here.
Wanted to talk about anyway, which is the first one is, do we no longer have a personal moral obligation to reduce our personal resources or perceptions? The second is, as an individual, how can we better enjoy the success of our species and society? And the last question is, do you think you inspire skills from the office character of the producer of the producer when basically tell everyone we're all going to die? There's nothing we can do about it. But thank you very much for having me on. I look forward to hearing your response.
All right, thanks. All those questions. Did you hear those questions, Dr. McPherson?
I only heard question three had something to do with the newsroom. Sorry, the rest was cutting out too badly. I couldn't hear it.
All right, so I'll through them with you one by one here. The first question that caller had was, do we no longer have a moral obligation to try and reduce our emissions? What I took from that was, should we forget about recycling and all those other kinds of, you know, being organic or trying to go vegan for the climate or something? Are all those things kind of a waste of time, or what's your stance on those kinds of behaviors?
I'm a huge fan, as I've been pointing out for decades in the classroom and out. I'm a huge fan of taking right action and of not being attached to the outcome. What does right action mean? Well, it doesn't mean, for example, people frequently tell me something like, I feel terrible because I'm flying to see my relatives in name a country. And I tell them, you shouldn't feel terrible because of the aerosol masking effect. It's important that you solidify or, in some cases, finalize those relationships with those people. If you stop flying and everybody else takes the same steps simultaneously, then we're going to be in even worse trouble than if you hadn't stopped flying. So my focus at this point is to not blame and not shame people into taking actions that at the global scale will prove irrelevant. Instead, I'm particularly interested in people being true to their authentic selves, whatever that means to them, to taking right action. And most people know what that means. It means not being an idiot. It means not being a quote, bad person to the people in your lives. It's about retaining the focus on your family and your community. And does that mean that we just throw the climate under the bus? Well, it's a little late for that. We did that decades ago, perhaps centuries. And so, but here again, I focus on not being attached to the outcome. And here's a classic example. In 21 years in the college classrooms, I told my students that the evidence indicated, going back a very long time, that reducing the human population was a relevant step. And that begins at home, obviously, with each individual. So I would encourage my students to not have children. I didn't have children myself. I made that decision at the age of 19. And there were a handful of my students who took that advice and didn't have children. Out of thousands of students, there were a few who decided not to have children. Was it because of something I said? Probably not. So were I attached to the outcome of my teaching, I would be a mess. It would have been driven me crazy because I was pointing out the obvious as we doubled the human population in my lifetime. So I think taking right action based on your conscience and not being attached to the outcome are relevant approaches that we all can take. Next question. Sorry for the length of my response.
Not at all. So I'm going to give the third question next, just because I think it's a little bit more bite-sized. So the caller was asking, there's a show called Newsroom, which I don't know whether it's on anymore, but I have Jeff Daniels from Full House, sort of like intrepid reporter kind of guy. And he had on a guest on the program, and the guest was saying how it's too late to prevent climate change. The caller was asking if you're familiar with that clip of the Newsroom and whether you think you inspired that scientist in that segment.
That's a fine question. Two questions, actually. I am very familiar with it because as soon as it came out, and I believe that was in 2014, so about 5 years ago, when it initially came out, I had several dozen people send it to me and say, oh my goodness, this has got to be based on your work. Look, it's you. It's you, the geeky scientist who's on the show. And I don't know that I was inspired. I thought it was a great piece of writing by Aaron Sorkin, by somebody who obviously understands the dire nature of the straits we're in. Did I inspire it? Maybe. I don't really know. A lot of people seem to think that that was the case. If that's true, then I'm still waiting for my royalty checks.
And the second question that that caller had, I think, sort of segues into talking overtly about your concept of planetary hospice. The caller asked, you know, how can we best enjoy this end of the lifetime, which is going to be for ourselves as well as for our society, our species, all the other species. Can you talk a little bit about, you have been talking about right action, not being attached to outcome, but just not just go on that, but also talk, as I was saying, about planetary hospice and sort of the ideas behind that in terms of guiding our action in the years ahead.
Yeah, you know, and this is where my work has been pointing for half a dozen years now, and I've been talking about planetary hospice as an appropriate strategy at the planetary level for at least a half a dozen years. And it hasn't gained a lot of traction, I think in part because there's not much money to be had in taking that approach for the corporate sector that is largely responsible for the messages we receive every day on the television, the radio, and the podcast, and whatever. So part of that planetary hospice approach, obviously, is telling the full truth. I think you'd be hard-pressed to come across somebody who is in hospice who is choosing to lie to people. Because if you accept that you're going to die in 6 weeks or 6 months, then I think most people in that situation would not lie to the people closest to them. And so hospice at the individual level, at a certain level, is about completing relationships with people, telling the truth that you might have withheld along the way about your family and your friends and your relationships. I would like to think we can do that at the level of a society as well. Now, what that means is every single individual taking that approach. What it means is every single individual being completely honest with everybody around them and using that honesty as a basis for deepening, strengthening the relationship with each person in their lives. At some level, that means completing relationships, because if you know you're going to die and your terminal diagnosis is 6 or 8 weeks, then I doubt you're going to lie to a bunch of people in your life. You're going to tell, you're going to apologize, maybe. Maybe you're going to seek an apology from the person you're speaking to. You know, when we were 17, you did this terrible thing to me, and I want you to own up to it. So let's have a conversation about that. Those kinds of things, if we can do that at the level of even families as individuals, if we can have that conversation, I think it will allow each of us to go into our own dark night a little bit more comfortable. Does that mean dying is going to be comfortable? No, I doubt dying is ever going to be comfortable for very many people. But that would maybe allow most people to have a no-regrets strategy or a no-regrets perspective when they did die, so that when somebody is on their deathbed in their final hours or final days, they wouldn't be thinking, you know, I wish I'd told my brother, fill in the blank. I wish I'd apologized to my sister about this terrible thing I did, and so on. So that's where I've been pointing for a long time. It seems that the idea might be getting a little traction. We'll see. I'd like to think that even if the society, the larger society, is not going to go that direction, then at least we can head that way ourselves. My co-host Kevin Hester and I recently interviewed Andrew Glickson, who's at the Australian National University, and asked him a series of questions for our radio show, which is on the Progressive Radio Network. And he indicated that every time he meets somebody for the first time, he assumes it is the last time he's going to see them, and he acts accordingly. And I thought that was a brilliant idea. So he has, for the last several years, been living as if each moment is his last, consistent with Homer's comment in the Iliad that any moment might be our last. So that encourages people to live with urgency and also to live with honesty. It encourages people to not lie to people, because who wants to be caught in a lie the 3 days after you die? Nobody. Nobody wants to be caught in that situation. So that's the general approach I've been taking for the last few years. Thank you very much for the question.
All right. We had one caller call in and ask if the show will be recorded, and it certainly will be recorded by me. It'll be up on speakingbroadlyshow.com later this afternoon. Dr. McPherson, perhaps you are also recording the show, but people will also probably be able to find it on your YouTube channel. Certainly an excerpt of a program I had was found on your YouTube channel. Could you go ahead and talk about where people can read or watch more of your analysis?
Yes, I will post this show the instant you send me the link at guymcpherson.com, and that's where you can find all of my work over the course of the last dozen years. I've been posting there, and initially pointing toward the demise of industrial civilization, and then more recently increasing the amplitude, if you will, increasing the urgency by indicating that we don't have long as individuals and as a species. So I began that blog a dozen years ago, adhering to the general idea that we have 100 years or maybe till 2100, like most people. And then ultimately I began shortening that timeline based on the evidence as it accumulated. And so that's where it takes us today with our time is very short, and now other scientists are starting to echo me. Essentially, none of them quote me in doing so, but there seems to be an increasing consensus in any event. I doubt we're there yet, or that we will ever be at the point of consensus in the scientific community on this subject, but at least there is increasing agreement that the things I've been saying might actually be supported by evidence, and that's all I can really wish for anyway.
So that caller who called in also had another question, which was in particular about the role of our animal domestication, killing, you know, millions of animals each day, each year. That caller was interested in your perspective on how we've gone about killing and raising other animals and how that's contributed to climate change as well.
Well, that's one of the things we do best, isn't it? Whether it's non-human animals or human animals, murder is one of our favorite strategies and something we've become very adept at. So good, in fact, that it appears we're going to murder all of us in a short period of time by one means or another. And obviously, I think that's terrible. And I became a vegetarian at one point for several years because I understood what was going on with the destruction of the animal world at human hands. And that again falls into the category of right action. How do you want to act? And, you know, I have... There's a balance to be struck here, because, for example, if we all go vegan, which depends upon the privilege of living in cities and growing grains, well, growing grains and growing almond trees at large scale are among the most destructive things we can do to planet Earth. And so where do we draw the line for us individual? I eat low on the food chain, and I abhor industrial meat for the plague it has become. And how you act as an individual must reflect your personal principles, obviously. I encourage people to spend more time thinking about what those personal principles are and how it affects their actions and how that might scale up at the level of society. But I'm also adamant in pointing out that the situation we're in right now not involve blaming and shaming people because we're in this situation. Because it's not you, Adam, and it's not me, and it's not 3,700 vegans who are destroying the planet. It's all of us, collectively. And more than that, it's our predecessors and the decisions that were made a dozen years ago and 100 years ago and 1,000 years ago and 10,000 years ago to, and further back than that, harnessing fire and harnessing the atom and growing grains at scale and storing food. And, you know, you can point to several dozen or maybe even several hundred individual phenomena that indicate we took a wrong turn. And blaming somebody today for those wrong turns in the past seems like a really bad idea to me.
Well, unfortunately, we are almost out of time. We have another minute and a half for you to, I think you've done a very wonderful job of tying things together here at the end. If there's anything else you'd like to say to our listeners, or just, you know, remind them where they can read more and watch more of your analysis. We've got about a minute and a half to wrap it up. Thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Adam. And my YouTube channel is called Nature Bats Last. That's the name of my blog as well. You can find my blog at guymcpherson.com. And you can find hundreds of video clips there and also hundreds of essays. I think it's around 1,200 essays now that I've posted in that space. My contact information is all there as well. So the bottom line is, when it comes to advice about living for individuals, I recommend living with intention, living urgently with death in mind, pursuing excellence, and pursuing love. And that's a short version of my whole message I've been trying to relay for a dozen years now. I think it's a good place to stop. Thank you very much, Adam.